You are listening to Discovering Virginia on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean. Today on Discovering Virginia, you'll discover the Edgar Allan Poe Museum in Richmond. Now, you know Edgar Allan Poe from his stories, The Cask of Amontillado, The Fall of the House of Usher, The Gold Bug, The Mask of the Red Death, Murders in the Rue Morgue, The Pit and the Pendulum, and The Purloined Letter, The Telltale Heart, and many others. You also know his poems, Annabel Lee, The Raven, To Helen, Lenore, and others. Poe was born in Boston, but he died in Baltimore. But he lived, loved, and worked here in Richmond, Virginia. So it's fitting that the Poe Museum is in Richmond. It's in the old stone house between 19th and 20th Streets on East Main. Chris Sempner is the curator at the Poe Museum. Chris, describe what you have in your collection.
We have the world's largest collection of Poe things. Everything from his socks to his bed, a lock of his hair, to movie posters and comic books and films and anything that was touched by Poe's life or his literature. And we really tried to tell the whole story, not only of Poe the man, but also the legacy of his inspiration for future generations of writers and artists and filmmakers and musicians. So we've got a little bit of everything here.
You might describe his time in Richmond, Virginia.
Well, he came to Richmond when he was a year old. His mother was a traveling actress. His father had abandoned the family, and his mother died here when he was just 2 years old. She had tuberculosis. He was taken in by John and Francis Allen. They gave him the middle name of Allen, or else he never would have had that middle name. He grew up in Richmond. He spent more of his life in Richmond than any other city. It's here that he first fell in love. He first became engaged, although her father broke off the engagement while Poe was away at school. He was married here. He began his career in journalism. He published his first horror story, his first novel, his only play. He always considered Richmond his hometown, and so when he bounced around from city to city, going to where the publishing centers were in New York and Philadelphia, he always called himself a Richmonder and a Virginian. He said, "I am a Virginian," in one of his letters. So this city left an indelible mark on him. It inspired the kind of artist that he would be. And from the beginning, he already defined himself as a Southerner, and he championed the cause of Southern literature. At the time, the major writers were Northerners. Washington Irving, who did The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, and James Fenimore Cooper did The Last of the Mohicans. So the Northern writers in the big cities up there, New York and Boston, were getting the lion's share of the attention. But Richmond was a relatively small town. When New York City had about 500,000 people, Richmond only had about 20,000. So Richmond was growing and trying to make its mark in the world. It was known as a political center, a place for political thought, for lawyers and for politicians. But Poe decided to make it a center of literature, and he started working at the Southern Literary Messenger, a magazine designed to cultivate literature in the South. Because Southern authors of the time were saying, well, why isn't there a Southern literary tradition? Why aren't there more Southern writers? I mean, we have as much wealth as the North. We've got the leisure time to write. We've got an audience that's very literate. Why aren't we writing more? And this magazine is supposed to cultivate that. And from the start, Poe opposed the Northern writers, and he called out the practice of puffery, where one writer would get his friend, who was a critic, to write a flattering review of his novel without even read it first. And he called out the most popular poets in the country, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, and said basically he's a quack, followed by a legion of literary quackery of no original ideas, but he does a fairly good job adapting other people's ideas. But Poe said the main thing was to make original literature, and that was what's going to be important, and that's what's going to set Southern literature apart from the rest. And Poe became the first American writer to have an international influence. Whereas Washington Irving was popular in England, Poe actually inspired English authors. He inspired Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Dante Gabriel Rossetti. And then in France, Jules Verne loved his work so much it inspired his science fiction work. And Jules Verne admitted to this. He loved the idea of Poe taking impossible stories like trips to the moon and making them seem plausible using real scientific details. And those are the hallmarks of modern science fiction. So Jules Verne loved his work so much he wrote a sequel to his story, The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym. Of course, French poets loved him, Baudelaire and Mallarmé just thought that this was a revelation, that Poe came out of this climate where he was told that a work of art, a work of fiction, was good because it helped edify you or make you a better person. That if you read something, it was supposed to teach you a moral lesson, that the hero is supposed to prevail, the villain should be vanquished, virtue should be rewarded, villainy should be punished. And here was Poe writing a story like The Cask of Amontillado, where the villain gets away with his crime. He bricks up a fellow behind the wall in the catacombs, leaves him there for 50 years. Here he is confessing on his deathbed, but he doesn't seem at all guilty about it. He's been rewarded for his villainy, and we sympathize with him. We join him as he's laughing at his villain's, at his victim's fate, as he taunts him all the way down there.
You mentioned he was at the Southern Literary Messenger, which is just a few blocks from the Poe Museum, or was at the time. Was he the editor, did he do most of the writing himself?
He was the editor. He was the acting editor. The boss at first didn't want to give him the title, just hired him on. This is a 26-year-old kid who'd won a short story contest. He'd been to UVA for one term, which was about a year, and he'd been to West Point, he'd been in the U.S. military, but his boss hired him and asked him to write some stories that would educate and entertain the public without offending them. So Poe sent in a story called Berenice, about a man who's a little bit obsessed. He can see a spot on the wall and stare at that spot for hours and lose track of time and go into a self-induced trance thinking about that spot. So one day he sees his wife smile, and he becomes obsessed with her teeth and fantasizes about her teeth. He'll go into a trance just thinking about her teeth. But then she wastes away and dies, probably of tuberculosis or some other common disease back then, and she's buried out in the family cemetery. And he didn't seem to care that much. He just goes back to his chamber and locks himself away and goes into a trance thinking about those teeth, dreaming about those teeth, obsessing over her precious pearly white teeth. And he vaguely remembers hearing screams and noises and these dreams, that the kind of dreams you forget as soon as you wake up. As one of his servants came to the door, starts banging the door, says, "Wake up, snap out of it. Your wife wasn't really dead. We accidentally buried her alive." They rushed to the cemetery. By the time they got there, somebody else had already dug her up. And she didn't have any teeth. And that's when the man wakes up from his trance, and he knocks this little box off his table. And you can imagine what tumbled out. And that got a lot of angry letters and complaints, and his boss almost fired him after that first story. But he told his boss, "Trust me, this is what's going to sell." He said, "This is how we're going to define Southern literature and American literature." And he said, "The more you insult or offend or annoy people, the more they're going to buy the magazine." And he was right. He boosted circulation 7 times in the first year, made the most popular journal in the South, established himself with a national reputation. Only got fired twice in the process, but they hired him back after the first time because they knew they needed him. But here he is. By the time he's 27, he's famous throughout the nation, at least in literary circles.
Chris Sempner, what do you have at the Poe Museum that illuminates this man, that makes him alive today? Some of his memorabilia, some of the things he wore, even.
Yeah, we're the only place in the world that has any of Poe's clothing that still survives. So you can look at his vest and his socks. You can see the boot hooks used to pull up his boots, and his walking stick he left in Richmond his last night in town, has his name inscribed on the tip. But when you look at the vest and the socks, you really get a sense of the man. This is a guy who was dirt poor. He was traveling from city to city towards the end of his life. He found that he could make a lot more money reading his poetry than publishing it. You know, the Raven got him $15 printing in a magazine, but he could make $100 in one night, a year's rent in one night, by reading it. So he started traveling, going on the road, selling out concert halls, selling out Athenaeums, and people all wanted to meet Edgar the Raven Poe. So he was sending money back home. He's trying to save money to start his own literary magazine. But you get this vest here, and this is a wealthy man's vest. It's silk, it's elegantly embroidered, and you really get the sense of somebody who, even though he was kind of poor, he was making himself look like a wealthy Southern gentleman. He was really playing the part. When you look closely, the armpits are a little bit frayed, there's signs of wear. When you look at the socks, you can see different places where his mother-in-law has had to sew them back together. And there's a little tear here, it starts to get worn a little bit here, and she's repaired them. But you really get that sense of somebody who's who's getting the most out of his clothing and wearing him and rewearing him. And some people knew him, described him as saying he's very elegant the way he dressed, but you could tell the clothes were a little bit old and they'd been brushed several times and mended several times. And another nice piece is his trunk. And it's a wealthy man's trunk. It's covered with tooled leather and brass buttons all over it. It's really a nice trunk. And it's the one he carried with him as he traveled the country, giving these readings in different cities. You can see how at the bottom there's scuff marks, and it's had some wear and tear as he's taken it from Boston to New York to Philadelphia to Richmond to Norfolk. And it finally ended up back here in Richmond. And Richmond's where he spent that last summer of his life. He, shortly before his death, he caught a steamship up to Baltimore where he's going to catch a train to Philadelphia. And he died up in Baltimore on the way. But he left his trunk in Richmond, and scholars have been wondering why he left his trunk. And a letter came up last summer. We'd already known about the half of the letter, but this missing half just turned up. And the reason he left his trunk in Richmond is because he still owed the Swan Tavern, that hotel where he'd been staying, some money, and they wouldn't give him back his luggage. So if it hadn't been for that, we might not have had the trunk. Because after he died, his sister and his mother-in-law fought over who got to have Edgar's trunk. You know, his sister just adored her big brother. His mother-in-law considered him her son, and they fought over it, and they got lawyers to represent them. They didn't care about the manuscripts and the books and things like that. They gave those to his literary executor so he could compile Poe's complete works. But they fought over the trunk, and each had their claims that, oh, she didn't really love him, he couldn't stand her. And finally, his sister outlived the mother by a couple years, so she got the trunk, and she left it with her foster family. And she died about 1874. And it came to the museum in 1923, and it came directly from her foster niece, who'd remembered growing up with her. And so every piece in the museum has a story behind it, and we can trace that story back to Poe, and we can follow it from auction house to auction house, or from one family member to another. And some of these things, it's amazing that they've even managed to survive all these years because of all the different owners and all just the quirks of fate.
You make Edgar Allan Poe sound like a great man, and yet when he died, he had his critics, or especially a critic.
Yeah.
And in a way, you have kind of revived his reputation.
Yeah, when Poe died, he was internationally famous. He had created a sensation in Europe. Elizabeth Barrett Browning wrote to him and said that The Raven has created a terror and a fit sensation in England. And all over the United States, he appeared as characters in other people's stories. And Thomas Dunn English has a novel called 1844, in which Poe is portrayed as Marmaduke Hammerhead, a drunken poet who's written a poem called The Black Crow. And so Poe was a controversial figure. We found out, though, that according to people who knew him, he never had an opium habit, and about a glass of wine got him staggering drunk. He'd be sick for days afterwards, so he really couldn't write if he'd been drinking. He tried to drink as little as possible. In fact, at the end of his life, he joined the Sons of Temperance, and he was a temperance advocate at the end of his life. But he's also a poet trying to get recognized for his poetry. His short stories were fabulously popular. He invented the detective story. The Murders in the Rue Morgue was a big hit. It was followed up by the Mystery of Marie Roget and the Purloined Letter, which also big hits. The Gold Bug was a treasure hunt mystery, the first work of fiction incorporating cryptograms in it. So if it weren't for this, we wouldn't have the Da Vinci Code or National Treasure. So he's getting recognized for his short stories, but he always considered poetry to be the true challenge for genius, and he wanted to be recognized as a poet. And fortunately, this fellow Rufus W. Griswold was a failed poet who turned to became an editor of other people's poetry. And he wanted to compile the first major anthology of American poetry. It's going to be called The Poets and Poetry of America. And Poe thought, I have to be in this book. He wrote this fellow, Rufus W. Griswold, a letter and said, I need to be in this book. He sent him some of his poetry and sent himself a little brief biography telling his life story. He says how he graduated first in his class at UVA and took off to Europe and fought the Greek Wars of Independence, was captured in St. Petersburg, Russia, was rescued from there and went over Europe. All made up. But Poe is really trying to puff himself up and create this image of himself. He is already working on his public image. So he knew he needed to be in that book. So sure, Griswold included the works of a lot of his poet friends, sometimes 20 by this one and 30 by another and 15 of another. And when it came to one of his favorite poets, he included 45 poems. But then when it came to Edgar, he only put 3 of his poems in there. And Edgar looked at this book and said, well, there's something wrong with this. All the well-represented poets are from New England. This should not be called the Poets and Poetry of America. It should be called the Poets and Poetry of New England. And he wrote some lukewarm reviews of it, but then he went on stage and went on a lecture tour making fun of this book and making fun of the overrided, bloated reputations of these writers that he'd promoted in the book, and of course made fun of Griswold. And even in one of Poe's stories, he has a character who gets more stupid by reading one of Griswold's books. And people thought this was hilarious. Of course, they wanted to attend these stand-up comedy routines in the guise of lectures and listen to Poe make fun of the New England poets. But Griswold always held a grudge. Poe just thought this was only business, you know, making good money giving these lectures or writing these reviews, ridiculing other authors. There might have been a personal element too. But after Poe died, Griswold was the most qualified one to compile his complete works. He was this famous editor and anthologist, so Poe's mother-in-law signed over the rights to everything to Griswold. Poe's mother-in-law and his sister, who was actually his closest living relative, didn't get any money for his writing. All that went to Griswold. They didn't know that Griswold had already printed an obituary of Poe, but it was so scandalous, he signed it with the name Ludwig. Didn't even want to put his name on it. It starts out, "Word of Poe's death will startle many, but few will be grieved by it. He had few or no friends," and portrayed him as this horrible, hateful person who wandered the streets at night mumbling curses to humanity. Now he got to be Poe's editor. So he decided, well, I'm going to include a biography of Poe with one of the volumes of this set. And it portrayed Poe as a madman, drunkard, womanizing, opium addict with no morals, a hateful, hated person. He said the reason that Poe and his foster father didn't get along is because he just implied that Poe had made a pass at his foster father's second wife.
All totally made up.
All totally made up. He was trying to skewer Poe and really get back at him. He'd have some faint praise for his literature, but then he'd say, you know, these horror stories are based on his own life. He's writing from his own experience of just being a hateful, villainous, insane person. And he thought this would just destroy Poe's reputation. Maybe they'd stop reading his works now. Maybe they'd finally get tired of Poe. Instead, it had the exact opposite effect. His complete works sold out in 3 editions in the first year, better than his works had ever sold during his lifetime. And these works they cemented Poe's reputation. Now, of course, many of Poe's friends came forward. Some of them, they were afraid of Griswold, the most popular anthologist in the country, and they waited until just after Griswold died to come out and publish their accounts refuting Griswold. But plenty of Poe's friends came out even while Griswold was alive and said, this is completely false, he's made this up, he's a nasty person. And Griswold was kind of a nasty person.
You're telling us a bit about Poe's life that we're not really familiar with, or should be more familiar with. You were the curator of the Poe Museum in Richmond, Chris. What do you hope people will find when they get to the Poe Museum?
Well, the first thing, I want them to get inspired. We love it when people leave the museum and they pick up a copy of one of Poe's books. We also love it when people leave the museum and they go home and they write something, or they make a film or paint a picture. I heard this story just a couple years ago about this fellow who came here with his parents once as just a kid, and he didn't want to go to a bunch of museums. He wanted to go on a family vacation. Maybe they wanted to go to Busch Gardens and have a good time there. And they made him stop by Richmond and see the Poe Museum. This is a kid from North Carolina. And when he got to the Poe Museum, he said it was just a wonderful place. He went to the Raven Room, and this is a room that's been painted blood red, and all around the walls were little illustrations to the Raven done back in the 1880s, all black and white illustrations by this artist James Carling. He became obsessed with the Raven, tried to illustrate the whole poem line by line. So this kid went into the Raven Room, this windowless, blood-red room, and he said it was just a magical experience. Years later, he told Entertainment Weekly that he just had an amazing, transformative experience seeing all these illustrations, and then later he decided to become a screenwriter, and he wrote the movie Scream. He wrote the Dawson's Creek series, Vampire Diaries. And then just a couple years ago, he decided to make a Poe-inspired TV series. And it's about a college professor in Richmond, where the Poe Museum is, who became obsessed with Poe and became a serial killer. And then Kevin Bacon started as the FBI agent who has to track him down. And it's called The Following. It was on Fox for about 3 seasons. And all this made possible by a kid visiting the Poe Museum.
Who was inspired.
He was inspired. And he became a very successful television and movie writer and director. And it's great to see the ways that just a visit to the museum can inspire someone they leave to create great things. And that's why we have an Edgar Allan Poe Young Writers Conference each summer, because we love that legacy of inspiration that went from Poe inspiring Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Jules Verne and Ray Bradbury and Alfred Hitchcock. Alfred Hitchcock said the reason he made suspense films is because he loved reading Poe's stories. And Poe was all about, you know, creating an effect on the reader. So he constructed his stories like a mousetrap to spring at just the right point. He's very interested in that audience response, and that's what Hitchcock did. And Hitchcock explained that's the way he made his suspense films. He's manipulating his readers, and Poe really understood the science and the art of manipulating his readers the same way Hitchcock did. And that's a legacy of inspiration. We also want people to come to the museum to see that Poe was more than just a horror writer, more than just the guy who wrote the scary stories, more than just the Vincent Price movies that play in late night television, that he also had a boundless imagination. Because of Griswold's biography, people tend to associate Poe with those horror stories, and they think that, oh, he must have written those because he's insane. But he also wrote comedies, a lot more comedies and satire than horror. Also science fiction about trips to the moon, about cyborgs, about the future and different worlds. And he was fascinated with technology and science, and he incorporated this into his works. Then, of course, his mysteries and inventing, defining the modern detective story. I mean, imagine a time when if there were a crime committed, a horrible murder, the police typically either had to catch someone in the act or get a confession. After that, they're often out of luck. And Poe wrote about a character, Auguste Dupin, who became the inspiration for Sherlock Holmes. And he's followed around by his sidekick, who became the inspiration for Dr. Watson. And Dupin solves crimes using reason and analysis. Is there any trace evidence here, like some stray hairs that look out of place, that maybe they could fit together and solve this mystery? He also tried to understand the way the criminal mind works, like in The Purloined Letter. That's a mystery about criminal profiling. Here the detective is trying to figure out where a villain has hidden an important letter from the Queen. And the police can't find it. They look all over the apartment. And they know it hasn't left the apartment. It must be there somewhere. So, of course, they're looking under every table. They're looking inside the legs of tables, see if they're hollow. They're looking in every book, to turn the books upside down and see if maybe it's been wedged in between some of the pages. And the detective says, well, of course, if you think about the way this guy's mind's working, he anticipates they're going to look in all these hidden spots. So the villain has just put the letter in plain sight, anticipating they're not going to look there. And that's one of the great things about Poe. He's come up with new stories and new ways to think about the world around us. He's changing the way things look to us. And there's real-life applications for this. If it weren't for detective fictions, where would modern crime scene investigation be today? If it weren't for stories about trips to the moon, where would NASA be? A lot of our early NASA engineers said they all grew up reading Jules Verne, and then they actually made it possible. These fiction writers have a way of showing us not just what is, but what could be. They show us those possibilities.
At the Poe Museum, do you have guided tours or self-guiding tours?
Oh, we have both. We have guided tours that leave each day at 11, 1, and 3. Then we have self-guided tours you can just take on your own. We either have ones you can just take using a map and then you can read the text in the buildings, or we have an audio tour and you can just use that and that'll explain to you what's going on, and also read some of Poe's poetry, which is perfect here because the centerpiece of the garden. If you haven't visited the Poe Museum, you probably think that you visit the museum, you walk into the center, you're going to see a torture chamber. Instead, you see a beautiful garden. And that's because way back in 1922, 94 years ago, when this museum opened, the founders loved his poetry, and they thought that's how Poe will always be remembered, is for his poetry. They tried to recreate one of Poe's poems, The idea was you would step into the garden and you would step into Poe's poem To One in Paradise. The lines, "Thou wast that all to me, love, for which my soul did pine. A green isle in the sea, love, a fountain and a shrine, all wreath and fairy fruits and flowers, and all the flowers are mine." So they listed all the different flowers and trees and shrubs that Poe mentioned in his poems and short stories, try to plant as mim here as they could. So the garden is full of different kinds of lilies and violets and daisies and roses, and just there's always something new blooming. It seems like there's always something out there blooming throughout the year. Everything out there is a piece of Poe's life. They paved walkways and built walls with bricks from different buildings where Poe lived or worked. You can sit on benches that are made of granite that was saved from the building in which Poe got married. You can see the urn and the base of the urn underneath it has bricks from Poe's home in Greenwich Village. Or you can stand in the Poe shrine with the bust of Poe, and the bricks all around you in that shrine came from the office, the Southern Literary Messenger, where Poe got his start in journalism. Everywhere you go, there's a little piece of Poe's life. There's ivy all around the garden. And the ivy came from Poe's mother's grave at St. John's Church. They transplanted some of it here, and it's been here ever since.
Thriving.
Thriving. It loves it here.
Chris, when is the museum open? What are the hours? Is there an admission charge?
Yeah, the museum is open every day but Monday. So Monday we just get things cleaned up and repaired and ready for the next week. But Tuesday through Saturday we're open from 10 until 5, and Sunday from 11 to 5. And the fourth Thursday of every month from April through October, we stay open until 9 and have an unhappy hour. It's kind of like a happy hour, but at the Poe Museum. And there's always live music and a cash bar supplied by some local brewery, and then food supplied by a local restaurant. And it's worth the $5 just to come and get some of that food. And not to mention the band, and then between sets of the band, we have a performance of one of Poe's stories or poems. So we've done The Mask of the Red Death and The Oval Portrait in recent months. And we changed out each month as a different theme. So when you go here, you know there's going to be a theme to that month. So let's say the theme was the murders in the Rue Morgue. We had a murder mystery. The guests started dropping like flies, and the survivors had to figure out who's doing it. And for the Mask of the Red Death, it was a plague theme and a party theme. And there's always something new, and we'd never want to have the same event twice. Then, of course, if you were to come on the Saturday closest to Poe's birthday, we have the big Poe birthday bash. We stay open until midnight that night. So all day, every hour, we have some kind of performance or talk or tour. We'll have live music, Poe-themed dances, dramatic performances and readings. This year, who knows what we'll come up with. There's always some new idea, but we keep trying to stretch ourselves and find new ways to tell Poe's story and to tell the story of his influence and why his literature is still relevant today. We want people who come here to get excited about reading and literature and art, and hopefully that'll inspire them not only to pick up a book, but also to write their own story when they leave. If you just come on any regular day, the admission is $6 for adults and $5 for students, seniors, AAA members, military, and teachers. We love to have teachers here. And we get lots of school groups and lots of adult groups from around the world. We regularly get groups coming from France and Germany. Of course, all the local schools from the counties, but also schools from California. And even ones who can't visit, we'll give them virtual tours through Skype. So they can see it. There can be a classroom in Ohio that gets to take a tour of the Poe Museum through the powers of the internet. That's one of the main reasons we're here, is to help inspire that next generation to read and to love reading. Because if you're a student today, if you can't comprehend written expression and learn how to express yourself verbally, you really can't get ahead. Even if you want to go into science or technology, it's fundamental that you know how to explain what you're doing. Einstein's general theory of relativity wouldn't have made any sense if Einstein hadn't been able to write it out, use analogies, and explain it. And Stephen Hawking would just be saying a bunch of gibberish if he hadn't been able to write that and explain it. We need to be able to come up with ideas and then to explain them to others. So we need reading and writing. It seems like it goes without saying. But then when you see SOL scores in English dropping, that's troubling for that reason. And we're trying to do our part to help get kids early and get them inspired for a lifetime.
The Edgar Allan Poe Museum is on East Main Street. It's in the old stone house on East Main Street between 19th and 20th. Chris Sempner is the curator of the Poe Museum. Chris, thank you.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Discovering Virginia on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean.